Sunday mornings we've been looking at the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 11. This book, this letter, was written to a group of Jewish Christians who were struggling in all sorts of ways. The Christian life had not been easy for these people. The writer talks in chapter 10 about a major crisis that they'd already been through in the past. Chapter 10, verse 32. Remember those earlier days after you'd received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property, because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. We don't know where or when these things happened to them, but it's obvious that at some time in the past they'd been hit by a wave of persecution. It says they were insulted and persecuted. It sounds as if whatever town they were living in, the people of that town had just turned against them. When the writer says they were insulted, it doesn't sound as if the authorities were taking official action against them, using the law against them. It sounds more as if there was just a campaign of nastiness against them by the local people. You can imagine what that would have meant, can't you? The insults as they walked through the streets, maybe the stones that came through the windows, the children being harassed, the employer who says, sorry, I can't keep you on any longer. The group of thugs who gather round the house chanting slogans. The police turning a blind eye to it all. I would guess that it was at that level that they were persecuted, at least initially. But then it started escalating. It became official. The authorities started fining them, confiscating their property. It's the old story. Maybe somebody started trouble against them, stirred up a riot aimed at them, property was getting damaged, and instead of the rioters being fined, it was these Christians, the victims, who were fined for provoking it all. Doesn't sound as if any of this group of Christians were actually imprisoned, but they knew of other Christians who were in prison and they sympathized with them. And these Christians had to live with this low-level persecution. Insults, sneers, harassment, fines. Well, we don't know how long that wave of persecution went on. But they came through it. They came through it wonderfully well. The writer says, you stood your ground. He says, you chose voluntarily to come to the support of other Christians who are having an even worse time. You stood with them. And incredibly, he says, you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property. Even when the authorities were snatching away your goods, you stayed smiling. You were still singing. You were still praising. Because you knew they couldn't take away your everlasting treasures. These Christians had come through that. They had come through that phase of painful harassment and persecution. Now, I don't know how long before all that had happened. But it seems that wave of persecution died away. Or maybe they got away from it. Maybe these Christians moved out of that town and got away from persecution that way. One way or another, they seem to have gone through a more peaceful time following that time of persecution. But now it looks as if things were getting more difficult again. There are just hints in this letter that the pressure was beginning to build up again. chapter 12, verse 3, the writer writes to them, "Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." Well, surely the point is that they are beginning to face opposition from sinful men again. And the only way they'll cope with it, says the writer, is by keeping their minds on Jesus. There'd be no relevance in what he's saying if they weren't beginning to face opposition again. Chapter 12, verse 4, he goes on to say, "You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." They're not yet being attacked physically. They're not yet being injured or killed. But it does sound as if they're experiencing suffering, doesn't it? And then you get chapter 13, verse 13. Let us then go to him, to Jesus, outside the camp, bearing the disgrace he bore. There's a hint there, isn't there, that if they take a public stand with Jesus, it's going to mean disgrace for them. It's going to mean humiliation. It's going to mean ill treatment. It's hard, isn't it? It's hard when you've been through an intensely difficult experience. And it's been a real struggle. But you've come through it without compromising. You've held on. You've been determined to stay loyal to the Saviour. You've fought the fight and you've won. And you think it's over. And then suddenly it all starts happening again. And you groan as you realise that you may have to go through it all again. It can happen with all sorts of different things. Here it was persecution. But it doesn't have to be that. A couple, let's say, have a rebellious teenage son. And he goes through a dreadful phase where he's doing all sorts of antisocial, self-destructive things. And they've got to live with the worry of that day after day. But eventually he begins to settle down. He begins to grow up. He actually seems to be developing a sense of responsibility. And he seems to be actually sorry for all the upset he's caused his parents in the past. And they're beginning to sleep again at night. And it's just wonderful. And then one day, Peter comes home from work. And he finds Marion, his wife, in tears again. Why? Because she's just had a row with their teenage daughter. The one they've never had any worries about. She just told Mum that she's going off to a party tonight and that they needn't expect her home. And they just feel it's all happening again. Have we really got to go through it all again? A Christian man loses his job. Mike's unemployed for 2 years. And it's hard, it's discouraging. Phoning up one company after another, writing those endless letters, going on training courses to prepare for jobs that don't exist. Nothing to show for it all, but he keeps praying. And eventually God answers his prayers. He gets a job. Okay, it means he's got to move house with all the trouble that means for the family. He's got to, because the job's on the other side of the country. The children have got to change schools. They've got to leave the church that they've loved and look for another church in that town. But at last they're settled. They're settled in their new home, in their new church, in their new school. At last, some stability. for 12 months. And then the news comes through that this new company is struggling and it's having to lay off staff. Last in, first out. And oh no, 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 we can't go through it all again, no! Whether it's in our work or our troubled relationships with people or in bereavements or in our experience of church life, it happens to so many of us at one time or another. We go through a really difficult period. We go through some crisis. We go through some intense disappointment. We go through some painful trial. And we're kept through it all. And we carry on obeying and trusting and praying and praising through it all. And eventually we come out the other side. And we breathe a sigh of relief and thanksgiving. And we have a few months or a few years of peace. And then it all starts happening again. And it's so much harder second time round. It's as though the first battle, though you came through it, still took something out of you. All right, you won. But you lost something of your freshness. You lost something of your resilience. Muhammad Ali was never the same after that first fight with Joe Frazier. Well, I think that's what happened to the people for whom this letter was written. They'd been through this intense period of persecution. They'd come through it. They'd stood firm. And they thought it was over. But now it's all starting again. And when you read the letter through, you can see the effect that this had on them. They were discouraged. Some of them were giving up going to meetings. They were becoming introverted, inward looking. They were cutting themselves off from other Christians. They didn't feel they had the energy to mix with other Christians. Some of them felt like giving up completely. Some of them were looking back to the days before they became Christians. And their lives seemed so much easier back then. Like I say, these folk were Jewish. And as Jewish folk, they were part of a solid, respected community with a great historical tradition behind it and with legal protection as well. Jewish folk were guaranteed freedom to worship within the Roman Empire. Well, now these Christians were asking, wouldn't it just be simpler just to go back and join the synagogues again? Wouldn't it be simpler just to merge back into our Jewish background? After all, we'd still be worshipping the same God. We'd still keep the same moral standards. Why deliberately provoke trouble? Why deliberately put ourselves or keep ourselves in a situation where we know we're going to be persecuted? Have you ever felt like that? Felt that it would be simpler just to give up? Just to stop fighting, to stop making an issue of things. I think that's the way the first readers of this letter felt. At least many of them did. When you're feeling like that, there is only one thing that will bring you through safely. And it's this. Faith. That's why the writer writes this chapter. It's all about faith. He wants to stir up faith. Strong, vigorous, living faith in his readers. Because that's the only thing that will keep them going. It's the only thing that'll give them back their hope and their joy and their resilience. It's the only thing that will motivate them to press on in the face of this repeated discouragement. And what is faith? Well, we've repeated it every week. Faith is, chapter 11, verse 1, being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Faith means keeping your mind fixed on the future things. The things we're hoping for. The things we're looking forward to. The world to come. And all its everlasting joys. Faith means being sure of those things because God has promised them to us. And faith means being certain of invisible things. Being certain that God Himself, the invisible God, is there. He's real. He's in control. He's supremely important. Faith is being sure that our invisible God is more real than all the things that you can see and touch in the world around you. That's faith. Looking beyond the here and now. Looking beyond this visible world. And having your mind full of the future joys and glories of the world to come. Having a mind that's full of God's invisible reality. That's what will stop Peter and Marion from despairing as their daughter's behavior becomes more and more bizarre. They'll be saying to one another, look, it's hurting, but this can't take away our everlasting happiness, can it? God's promised that everything will be well in that world and there'll be no more tears. Our God is real, isn't He? He's in control. He is hearing our prayers. He's invisible, but He's not absent, is He? That's what will keep them going. That's what will keep Mike from giving up when he gets his redundancy papers. He really believes in a world where there's joy, endless joy for all God's people in Christ. He really believes in an invisible God who works all things together for good for those who love Him. That's what will keep these Jewish Christians from giving up, going back to their old lives. When the stones start flying again, when the dog dirt starts coming through the letterbox again, that's what will enable them to stand. The writer's saying to them, keep your mind fixed on the future. On the joys to come. The new heavens, the new earth with all its endless delights. Keep your mind fixed on the invisible. The invisible God. The invisible world of heaven. The invisible love that was given to you before the world began. The invisible power that sustains the universe and now holds you. Keep your mind on the invisible things. That's faith. Now, here in this chapter, Hebrews chapter 11, the writer gives his reader a long list of people who lived before they did. People from Old Testament times who came through all sorts of crises by faith. They came through because they really believed that God was working out a wonderful plan which would lead to their everlasting happiness. And they really believed that the invisible God was there for them. Real, supremely important. Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses' parents. Who can remember their name from last week, by the way? Meg can.
One of them was Jochebed.
Jochebed, that was her. And dad was Amram. Wonderful. Moses' parents. And last week then we started talking about Moses himself. That was the thing they all had in common. They were sure of the future. They were sure of the invisible. We saw last week Moses had a great decision to make. Would Moses choose to live as an Egyptian, enjoying all the pleasures of Egypt and joining in all the sins of Egypt? Or would he live as one of God's people, looking forward to the coming of Christ, looking forward to the everlasting blessings that Christ brings? What did Moses choose? We're told in verse 25, he chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God, rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than all the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking forward to his reward. That was his choice, and he made it by faith. Now, in one sense, that was a one-off choice. I think he made it, said it last week, at that point when he came to the rescue of a Jewish slave and rescued him from an Egyptian slave driver. He decided then that he wanted to belong to God's people, that he wanted the blessings of Christ, that they were more precious than all the treasures of Egypt. It was exactly the same choice that you make when you say once and for all, I want to belong to Jesus Christ. I want him to save me. I want him to bless me. I'm going to be baptized in his name. I'm going to join his people. It's a definite one-off decision. And you make it by faith. By faith, Moses chose. It was a costly decision. It meant he had to flee from Egypt. It meant he had to live a life of poverty and hard work out in the wilderness. Moses, the prince of Egypt, finished up working as a hired shepherd out in the desert. Can't have been an easy life. But it was the result of his choice. He had chosen to belong to God, and to God's people, whatever the cost. And even there, when Moses was working out in the wilderness, God was good to him. As time went by, he began to find some contentment and happiness. He got married, he had a son, he became part of a wider family. And then suddenly, his peaceful, happy life came to pieces again. Most of you know the story. God confronts Moses at the burning bush in the wilderness. And God gives Moses an impossible task to do. God tells him to go back to Egypt. He ran from Egypt all those years ago because he was afraid of Pharaoh. But now he's got to go back and face Pharaoh, because God is sending him. And he's got to go and tell Pharaoh to his face to let the Israelites go free. They're Pharaoh's slaves. Pharaoh needs them to be for his great building projects. And Moses has to go and demand freedom for his fellow Israelites. And then he, Moses, has actually got to lead them out of Egypt. Well, Moses isn't a confident man. Moses doesn't think of himself as a natural leader. He's very conscious. He's a poor speaker. He may even have had some sort of speech impediment. And yet Moses obeys. He goes back to Egypt. And he makes his way to the palace. Maybe he tells them who he is. Well, I'm the adopted son of an Egyptian princess. The one who vanished some years back. And now I'm here on behalf of the Israelites. One way or another, he's admitted to Pharaoh's presence. Pharaoh, one of the great emperors of the ancient world. He's worshipped by his own people as a god. He claims absolute power for himself. He's beyond any law. If Pharaoh lifts his little finger, the guards will close in around Moses, drag him off and torture him to death. Here's Moses, this weather-beaten shepherd out of the desert, leader of a nation of slaves, and he's standing before this vast golden throne, craning his neck to see the great king of Egypt. Will he lose his nerve? Will he keep quiet about why he's been sent there? Or will he stammer out some sort of apologetic request? Well, there was something I was hoping you might consider. Listen, this is Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, that they may hold a festival for me in the desert. Moses is so bold. He's got a message from God, and he is going to deliver it. And it doesn't matter if Pharaoh gets angry. It doesn't matter if Pharaoh orders Moses to be persecuted. Moses must do what God has commanded him. Well, what gives Moses that courage? The courage to stand up against the king's anger. It's faith, isn't it? Moses is sure that the invisible God is there in that room, and that his power is greater than all of Pharaoh's power. He's sure that God is in absolute control, and that Pharaoh can't lift a finger unless God allows it. And he's sure that God is working out his great purpose for his people, that God is going to lead them back to their own land, that they are going to be a great nation again, and that the Messiah, the Savior, is going to come to Israel one day, and he is going to rescue the whole earth. Moses is sure that God's promises cannot fail. And having that certainty gives him courage. He's not going to be intimidated by all Pharaoh's threats. Well, Pharaoh was certainly very angry. And yet he didn't command Moses to be arrested. For whatever reason, Moses was allowed to walk out of the palace. But Pharaoh acted very quickly to show how angry he was, commanded his slave drivers to clamp down on the Israelites, make them work harder, break their spirit. Moses had to face the backlash of that. The Israelites began cursing him for the trouble he brought on them. You see, Pharaoh's power was real. He really could make life a misery for the Israelites and for Moses. But still, at least Moses has done his work now, hasn't he? He's gone to Pharaoh. He's spoken out. He's risked persecution. And he survived. Now he can leave it all with God. Exodus chapter 6, verse 19. God said to Moses again, go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, let the Israelites go. Moses protests, but he's not going to listen to me. Please don't put me through this again. You know I'm not up to it. You know I've got this nervous stammer. I can't talk fluently. Please don't make me. But God won't let Moses off the hook. Exodus chapter 6, verse 28. Tell Pharaoh everything I tell you to say. And so began the long battle between Pharaoh and Moses. Again and again and again, God sends Moses back into the palace. Again and again, Moses has to face Pharaoh and deliver God's message. Do you think it became easier with time? I have never noticed in my experience that things become easier with time. Not if they're frightening things. Not if they're things you don't really feel up to. You know, I remember reading the autobiography of one of our bomber pilots who flew over Germany in the Second War, flew scores of missions, but the sense of terror didn't grow less with each mission. It grew. Every mission took something more out of him. He became more jittery. His cruise nerves more and more stretched. You know, I felt sick with nerves the first time we set up our book table on Castle Street. And actually forced myself to approach somebody to give them a tract. I still feel sick with nerves every time I do it. It doesn't get easier. I think every time Moses went into that palace, he went there with fear and trembling, feeling sick as a parrot. And yet he stood there. He confronted the great king. Why? What enabled him to do it? Only this: God was more real to him than Pharaoh. The writer says he didn't fear the king's anger. When it came to it, Moses could say, I am not afraid of him. I've got God with me, and he's greater than Pharaoh. Pharaoh can't harm me. And I'm looking forward to that new wonderful world that God has promised one day. And Pharaoh can't take it away from me. I'm not afraid of him. That's faith. There were moments during that long drawn out battle when Moses thought it was over. You remember God sent that series of terrible plagues on Egypt? The first one was when he turned the water of the Nile into blood. It made no impact on Pharaoh at all. Didn't even take it to heart. It says that in Exodus 7:23. But then came a second plague, a plague of frogs. And this time it seemed as if Pharaoh had cracked. Pray to the Lord to take the frogs away, and I will let your people go. Well, what a moment that must have been for Moses. We've won. It's over. I'm not going to have to go through this again. But within 24 hours, Pharaoh's changed his mind. And Moses does have to go through it again. And again. And again. Remember we talked at the beginning about how hard it is when you face a crisis and come through it and then find you have to go through it a second time? Well, it wasn't just a second time for Moses. It was over and over and over again. Pharaoh would give in. Moses would think, phew, we're through. And then his hopes would be dashed yet again. And he'd find he's got it all to face again. One more terrifying confrontation with Pharaoh. One more outburst of anger from this brutal tyrant. More threats. It's such a roller coaster. There's no knowing how Pharaoh would react on any occasion. When, with some of the plagues, Pharaoh seemed to be really shaken, willing to promise anything. With others, he wanted to offer some sort of compromise deal. All right, you can go, but you'll leave your children here. Or you'll leave your livestock here. With others, he just blew his top. Became even more angry. Moses never knew what he'd face when he went into that palace. To go to Pharaoh once took nerve, didn't it? To go twice took extraordinary courage. But Moses had to go back into that situation a dozen times, never knowing what to expect. That took more than courage. That took faith. The sort of faith we've been talking about. Certainty that God's promises are absolutely reliable. Certainty that the invisible God is there, supreme, all-powerful. The last mission was the worst. It ended with Pharaoh in a fury, screaming at Moses, "Get out of my sight! Never come here again! If you ever see my face again, you will be dead!" I wonder how I'd have coped if I'd faced that sort of anger. I think I'd have gone home shaking from head to foot.
And yet in the end, Moses won. Or rather, the Lord won. There came that last, most dreadful judgment of all, the death of the firstborn. And finally Pharaoh said, go, go now. And Moses left Egypt. And he took the Israelites with him. And he took their children with him. And he took the livestock with him. And he set off towards the promised land. Towards that destiny of blessing that God had promised his people. What does the writer say? By faith Moses left Egypt. Not fearing the king's anger, he persevered because he saw him who was invisible. Yes, he persevered. He kept going back to that palace. He kept delivering God's message in the face of opposition and threats and anger and persecution. And it was faith that gave him the strength to persevere. Being sure of the invisible God. Being sure of God's promises. Are you afraid of confrontation? I am. I hate situations of confrontation. Whether it's with a neighbour or a shopkeeper who sold me a dodgy item, I go and I apologise to him because he sold me a duff item. Or someone to whom I've just given a leaflet on Castle Street. I hate confrontation even when there's nothing really the other person can do to me. Even when I know that their threats are meaningless, I just hate confrontation. Well, the people to whom this letter was sent had already had some really horrible confrontations. And there were more on the way for them. And if we are real Christians, and if we live by God's commands, then we will face confrontation too. And it may come in waves. And when we think it's all over, we may have to go through it all again, and then again, and then again. Confrontation with employers, with colleagues, with family members. Tragically, even with fellow Christians at times. And it can be really frightening. And the threats they make aren't always empty threats. Will you persevere? Will you carry on being loyal to the God who's called you? Can you persevere in the face of repeated hostility? If you're struggling, if you're frightened at the thought of more confrontation, more opposition, more conflict, well, you've got a great role model here, haven't you? At times when it seems hard for you, well, you think of Moses. You think of him walking up the steps into that palace. You think of him standing there in that great hall with armed guards scowling all round the walls. You think of him looking up into Pharaoh's face, seeing the fury there. Think of Moses going back there day after day after day, saying, I'm not afraid. The invisible God is with me, and he's promised me everlasting life. Think of Moses' faith. But then think of a better role model. Chapter 12, verse 2, we read it earlier, let's read it again. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. He's the author and perfecter of our faith. He's the one who comes at the front
of the line of men and women who have had to live by faith. And he's the one who comes at the end of the line too. He's the great example. He's the role model. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. He scorned its shame. He sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him. He endured such opposition from sinful men. He's your role model. Jesus, standing there in the temple with angry men around him, hurling their hostile questions at him. He's the role model. Standing there in the court of the high priests as the witnesses shout lies about him and the high priest bullies him. He's the role model as he stands there in a courtyard with Roman soldiers standing around him, punching him in the face. They've blindfolded him because they're cowards, so he doesn't know where the next blow is going to come from. He's the role model standing before Pilate, the sneering Roman governor. Ah, so you're a king, are you? He's the role model walking through the streets, stumbling under the weight of his cross, while people laugh and mock. He's the role model hanging on a tree of wood, while people scream their abuse. He saved others. He can't save himself. That's faith. That's faith. How could he keep going? How could he go from one of those situations, one of those confrontations to the next? He did it, says the writer, because he knew that his Father's promises were true. That on the other side of the cross there was joy, everlasting joy. Because he knew that the invisible God was working out a plan to rescue the whole universe, to rescue those people on whom Jesus had set his love. Moses, what a role model. But I need more than a Moses to set me an example. I need a Saviour, a Jesus, to live in me by his Spirit. That's the only way I'll survive when the confrontations come, when I'm called to be loyal in impossible circumstances, when I'm called to surmount one more hurdle, to face one more heartbreak. It's the only way I'll survive, if Jesus is living in my heart. You need him. Every one of us needs him.